Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Kirk Gray.
And this is Fred Schenkelberg. Hey, Kirk, we got a question, and it was actually sent through through my About page, which is a way of many ways to get in touch with us.
We love questions.
It was one that I was like, I don't know, how many questions do you get, Kirk, where the immediate response is, well, what's the failure mechanism? And that was my first deal. So the outline of the question was, I've set up this test and we're cycling our product or cycling something. He didn't get into a lot of details. We're doing a cycle test and running it. But because of the way we set up the jigs, it's probably a benchtop test and you have different equipment and different setups and everything else. So they're all, his issue was, is they're running at different speeds or different rates. So one, and he didn't give me details, but imagine one's running at 5 cycles a minute, another one's running at 10 cycles a minute or whatever units make sense for that particular product.
Right.
And the question is, well, how do I combine these? Because an hour at 5 cycles is not the same as an hour at 10 cycles, right? And so he was trying to do the math to combine the hours. And so immediately my first question is what we were just chatting about was, well, what's the failure mechanism? does cycling even matter?
Right. Well, I look maybe back from a larger picture. That's what I have a problem with, statistics and just counting things, counting failures and, saying, okay, from Weibull analysis to whatever, I've heard talks and I want to sit there and I'm screaming in my head, what is the failure mechanism? That is the key. What are the physics that are driving this fatigue damage or chemical reaction? Or
is it creep or deformation or wear?
Evaporation of lubricant? Is it? What is it that you're looking for or suspecting is a problem? Or have they not had any failures yet? Is that it?
Oh, I don't know. I didn't get that in the email, and we've traded emails a couple of times.
Is he trying to combine it to? An MTBF?
I don't know. He's a longtime listener and all of this stuff, so he knew better than ask for that. But I understand not being, I'm working on this product and this issue from this vendor and all that, without an NDA in place. But the idea was, there's lots of ways to answer that question from a statistics point of view.
If
it's a failure mechanism that you understand. And I went into, if you're setting up a test and you're life testing stuff, and let's say it's supposed to go 100,000 cycles in nominal use conditions, right? In lifetime, whatever.
Right.
So we often then set up pneumatics or all this other stuff. We push buttons, we do all kinds of weird stuff. And we usually don't like testing by hand 100,000 times. So we set up something to do it, which is fine. If it replicates the failure mechanism that occurs in the field, right? I've seen push tests that completely do different things than what the field failures are showing up as. And then we're surprised. Sure. Why are they failing so soon?
Sure. Right.
So it's, what is the failure mechanism? Like button pushing, if it's a dome button, a little dome structure, and you push it, little bubble, and it deflects, makes contact, and then it's, that dome is a spring, and it brings back up. One of the common failure mechanisms for it, and there are a couple others, but one that I've seen most often is that dome cracks, and it loses its spring. So it makes contact, and it doesn't come back, or it's intermittent, or it doesn't make contact at all. But basically, it cracks from just metal fatigue. And you go enough cycles, it cracks. And this is where statistics comes in handy, is because different pressures, different frequency of pushing it, different metal thicknesses, different ways it's formed, different ways it's anchored, all those small variations, even though it's the identical part and product and use, you get a different number of cycles to failure. And that's where statistics is pretty handy, right? What's the number of cycles to failure on average and all other stuff?
Right, which would be a wear-out mode, right. Usually. I mean, you know, you could have a defect in the switch or in molding or something like that that causes an early failure.
Right.
But for the most part, you're looking at a life cycle time or life cycles like you would be with lithium ion batteries or something like that that you know has a distribution. We'll have everything has a distribution, and one of the other conditions might be temperature of the switch too. If it's an outdoor bubble switch, what do you call it? Membrane switch, I think they're called. It's going to have a different fatigue at temperature, especially if it's a polymer material or something like that. Yeah. So, you know, you still are going to get a general number that's not necessarily going to represent all the distribution of the field conditions. And that's another, you know, there's so many factors and variations that can occur in the manufacturing of that little membrane switch.
Right. And that's where I ran into one group one time, and to completely unnamed, but I'll use the switch example. You know, they put 100 units on tests, and they're pushing all these buttons. Right. And 10 of them failed pretty quick, like in 100 cycles.
Wow.
And they said, well, that's early defects. We don't pay attention to those. And I'm like, wait a second. You had 10% of your units failed early. Why is that? Oh, they were poorly manufactured. And these were sampled from production. And I'm like, and you're just going to ignore it? No, we're doing a life test.
Right.
No. What's the failure mechanism?
Exclude that. Yeah. Are they going to exclude that sub early failure population? Oh, that's infant mortality.
We don't do those. That's a quality issue. Yeah. Or worse, they combine it with the other long-term failure mechanism and they just combine it. Now you've got two failure mechanisms that are mucking up your data. So it's really hard to interpret it. So when you see when you mentioned earlier, when I look at a Weibull plot and they have time to failures and it's kind of screwy looking fit, but you go, what's the failure mechanism? Because it really only works for a failure mechanism. And we often count failures and throw them on a Weibull plot to see what's going on. But that's not the end of the story. You got to understand what's failing, what's dominating that curve. And then I think what your point is, Kirk, and I totally agree, is once you know what the failure mechanism is, then you can go do something about it.
Yeah, it's no longer need to count it. It's to understand it and how to mitigate it or to improve the strength of whatever it is that you're dealing with.
Yeah, and I'd say continue to count because I'm a statistician because you want to know if it's actually working or not, right? Did your fixes make a difference? You know, and it's kind of an important
retest,
piece.
Right.
Well, retest, but it's also – now, the other part of this question was –
Measure it too while you retest.
Well, there's that. But no, part of the question is, you know, we're doing this cycle testing and it wasn't clear if this, you know, running in built-in self-test on software or was it a material that's, you know, an arm that's extending out and coming back, for example, and exercising a joint. I don't have any idea what the product is, but let's say, does the speed of the cycles matter?
Yes.
Right. It, of course it does.
It can.
Yes, it can. But if you're completely, if the excitation, you know, if it's just the flex of this cable out and back and you're staying within the elastic region and all this other stuff, and it's not going through any phase transition, it's not internally heating, it's on and on and on and on.
Right.
If it's doing it twice as fast as versus half as fast, it ends up at the same place after 7,000 cycles, it cracks and fails, right? Roughly. And if it does that, no matter what speed you're going, well, then you can treat that test just as it's a count of cycles and you're dealing with it. It just happens to be slower or faster. But I've run into it with this one guy. He decided he wanted to get this test done quick. So he attached this little joint that was in a little cylinder and it was joining two different cylinders with this flexible membrane. Yeah. And he attached it to a drill that just whipped it around, you know, 8 gazillion cycles per minute. And eventually it cracked and fell apart. And then they would count the time versus the revolution rate they were having and how many cycles of it. And that thing, it was hot to the touch.
Yeah,
it was just,
and that very much changed the material conditions.
Oh yeah, and it was banging back and forth in this fixture. It was getting shock on top of everything. And I'm like,
and
the use application, it was going to be embedded in a body, and it had to be flexible because of person's movement.
Well, yeah,
we don't generally, unless you're doing some hardcore yoga or aerobics or something, you're not bouncing and bending 400,000 times a minute.
Yeah. Right, and the body, it stays pretty much a set temperature of 98.6 Fahrenheit.
And it's a great conductor of heat. It'll you create any little internal heating, it'll just transmit it all over the place and get rid of it.
Right,
I mean it does all these cool things, but you want to get the test done quicker, and now you got a completely different failure mechanism.
Well, I know I've mentioned it before that one of the standards for the big computer company I used to work for was testing USB ports and unplugging and unplugging. Yeah. And I did have a report from one of the vendors or one of the major system producers of, we had pushed the testing off to them, even though I actually had people physically insert and unplug and plug in USB into a desktop computer 5,000 times, which was real annoying to the technicians, but they did it.
Yeah.
But then, I saw early failures of a USB test from overseas, and I said, well, that's, we haven't had any failures of USB plugs cycling. And I said, can you send me a picture of your fixture and your setup and your test configuration of your test thing?
They had three gorillas, hairy knuckled gorillas doing
it. Almost. They had a pneumatic cylinder. I don't know if it's solenoid or pneumatic, that was just basically pushing in a USB male into the female on the
you could see the side of the frame just bending as you're going.
Well, no, it was just straightforward, straight in and out, and then they might have been doing I don't know, about a cycle a second or something like that,
just jamming it back and forth.
Well, these fixtures kind of may have been slightly off, or after a while, because you're talking about a lot of vibration with this sliding back and forth with a pneumatic or a solenoid. And, they become slightly misaligned, but there was no feedback to the device, the test.
There's too much force here.
There's too much force, or you're jamming it in and you're getting resistance. And we know in the real world, a human hand would not likely keep jamming into a plug at full force trying to get it to fit.
Some might, if your keyboard's just not powering
really
up.
You get really mad at it.
But I mean, part of it is there's a range. There's a range of forces that is in the use environment, right? And there are some people that just really, but we don't design for the, the guy that's 700 pounds sitting on his cable and jamming it in there,
But he wouldn't do that. This mechanism continued to do it overnight.
Right. And just keep eating away the side of it.
It just kept jamming that USB plug, and pretty much it kind of got mangled in front. And they showed me the pictures of it. Of course, it was, as soon as it got out of line, it was just hitting against the
metal and metal and bending all stuff all over.
Yeah, messing it all up.
With the other issue with that style of cycle testing, where it's automated and it's just a mechanical alignment.
Right.
If they solve those engineering problems that it's monitoring the force and it's doing all this other stuff,
right,
it doesn't have the variability of what a person does. We come into it at angles, we have it upside down, we've got it way and that. And and so it's, part of it is, I think, beyond what's the failure mechanism, it's also how is it actually used? What is the way people interact with your system, or how your system interacts with other things? What is nominal? And I always say, the closer you can get to your, expected way it's actually used with all the various stresses, the more information you're going to get. Now, the trade-off is it usually takes more time. And it's more difficult to do multiple stresses all at once and more costly to get all the various stresses and all the sequences that a day in the life of your product experiences.
Right.
But by understanding the underlying failure mechanisms, what are you testing for? What is it of interest? Then you can tailor that to really hone in and check all those assumptions. If I go faster, does it heat up? Does it do this? Does it do that? Do I do a phase change? Do I do this? Do that? If you don't check all those things, your test can very, very quickly give you just absolutely bogus information. It doesn't matter what statistics you do on it. It's not going to help.
No. But I do want to say and interject that it doesn't always... Okay, one of the things in highly accelerated limit testing, sometimes called life testing, is that the...
Wait a sec. Did you just change what HALT stands for? Do I have to write that down?
No, we're kind of slowly evolving, Fred. And more people are using highly accelerated limit testing.
Okay, I didn't know that.
More descriptive term of what you're actually doing. Yeah, okay.
That's true.
What you're doing.
It's
finding limits, you know. So anyway, one of the things is, well, it'll never see that in its end-use conditions is the argument for testing at extreme cold or extreme hot or extreme, you know, vibration. As long as the mechanism that you're finding through those methods is a potential weakness that could manifest itself over time through different stresses. For instance, vibration fatigues solder joints, but so does thermal cycling over time. So you just get acceleration of that same fatigue damage onto that that solder joint and shorten the time. But you've got to be careful. But for instance, you know, testing connectors at high and low temperatures might be a way of testing for dimensional tolerance or variation that you're going to have when you test, when you manufacture thousands or millions of those connectors, that you are dimensionally varying. And it's just like I say with semiconductors, you are going to have a variation in the timing, no matter how well your semiconductor fabrication process is controlled. There's always going to be a variation around any single device type. It may be very slight. You hope it is.
Yeah.
But one way is to vary that timing that's going to simulate the variation in the population of a high production component is to heat and cool it. Not that it'll ever see that necessarily in its in-use life or in-use environment or application, which, of course, there could be hundreds or thousands of applications for a device. But you can, and this is where it's important to do it in a system, how all these devices play together. Yep. But you can essentially change the speed of electrons in semiconductors by hot and cold. And we know that the speed in a large population of the same device will vary.
Yep.
And so this is a way of stimulating variation that you're going to see with a few parts instead of, you know, the thousand that you would have to test to really see that.
And even then it would be hard to in a when you're making prototypes versus millions, it's hard to sample then to get that variation.
But you have to make the link between what you're, you know, the conditions you're changing and how that would also, you know, like I say, no, it may not be used in that cold environment or that hot environment.
But it changes the materials properties,
But we know that we will have dimensional tolerances and speed and, you know, timing variations in, you know, semiconductor devices, and we'll have dimensional tolerances in connectors and physical mating devices or whatever. Mm-hmm. And this is a way of easily, you know, or the most easy, of course, to change the slight dimensional tolerances, and you hope that
it just works. It's,
the variation is very slight in your manufacturing tolerance, so you know you're really changing.
Let's not get into wishful thinking there, because you know it's going to vary. But back to the question. I mean, if you've got if you understand the failure mechanism, then you can translate the different rates of testing to a common denominator and then convert it back to whatever your use conditions is. So that's the ideal one. If the different rates excite different failure mechanisms or different phenomena that are causes failures in your product, then no, then you can't combine those. They are exciting different things and they're separate. You got to treat them as different items on a, you know, Pareto chart saying, which one do I need to solve? No, there's no magic formula without understanding the failure mechanism. And so part of designing a good test is understand the failure mechanisms and to design it appropriately. On the other hand, if you find things and you didn't know how it was going to fail, like doing halt, for example, is ideal. Then you go find the failure mechanisms. It's what made it fail. It's key. Right. And then you can go ask those questions. Well, what can we do about it? Or will it last long enough in our use?
Is it a manufacturing defect or is it a design flaw?
Oh, we can ignore all the manufacturing ones because those will never happen.
Well, they're annoying to get in halt because it's not representative of what you are trying to find the nominal unit and find out what the weakness is in the design, not necessarily what the weaknesses are in the manufacturing process.
Well, yeah, and I'm being facetious. You don't ignore them. Those are still serious issues. You got to deal with them.
But they're not what you're trying to find in a halt test necessarily, even though it's beneficial.
Yeah.
And you can do something.
But it goes back to, you and I talk about this all the time. What is the failure mechanism?
And that is the bottom line to all reliability, isn't it? Oh, yeah.
It is. It really, really is. And which may be a topic for a whole nother discussion. What's the minimum you need to know kind of thing? The trouble is that every failure mechanism is way cool in and of itself. So there's no ending to how we continue to learn material science or physics or chemistry or wherever else. But anyway, I hope, you know, the question, I sent a couple of comments in line with what we're talking about today. Here we expanded it a little bit. So if you're facing, you know, a test setup or you're getting different test jigs and stuff like that and trying to figure out how to combine this information to something useful, what's the failure mechanism? You know, we're going to ask you that question, but you know, if you got a question or you're exploring, is this the right approach or not, whatever, let us know. It, just like we got this question the other day that we enjoyed talking about, we'd love to have you join the conversation. So head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. That's one way you can get in touch with us, through a voice message or a written message, or you can get Kirk or I or the other host of the show through LinkedIn or our About pages, as this question came in today, was through an About page. But irregardless of what method you use, we'd love to hear from you. We're up over 700 episodes so far, and I'd say, at least half of them have been inspired by questions we've received in one form or another over the years. And so it does make a difference to us, and we'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, that's the best way we can get to answer what you're concerned with. So, and what you're doing on your personal, you know, jobs, and hopefully developing a reliable product.
Yeah, then we all benefit from that. All right. Well, thanks much, Kirk. We'll talk to you later. I'm not going to touch any USB ports today. I'm just going to let them idle, let them cool off.
I'm sure they'll disappear over time as we go totally wireless.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure it will. All right. Well, thanks, Kirk. We'll talk to you again soon.
Okay, Fred. Talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.